The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish, and Alex Kratosky is away, swanning around in Delhi, no less. This week, we turn the whole programme over to the extraordinary events that have taken place on the web over the last fortnight. From my seat in the studio, I can see the war room where The Guardian coordinated publication of stories on the US diplomatic cables, along with four other newspapers, that were leaked to whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Since those stories began, major internet companies and services have been taken offline in a battle between hackers and governments, all over the principle of the freedom of the internet. In this programme, we'll discuss whether this could be the first cyber war, as well as looking at what has happened so far and how the attacks took place. We'll hear how Tom Cruise's video on the virtues of Scientology spawned the anonymous hacking group responsible for many of the recent attacks. And an expert on electronic transactions gives his view of the success of the Operation Payback attacks as he ponders the future of the internet. Joining me in the studio today is The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur. On the line, we have Professor William H. Dutton, Director and Professor of Internet Studies at the Oxford Internet Institute. And we have Graham Cluley, Senior Tech Consultant from Sophos. Thanks for joining us, everyone. There's plenty to cover, so we're going to get stuck right in. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Let's begin the programme with a look at what has happened up to this point. Now, in this programme, we're not going to debate the ethics of the release of the cables, nor really their content. If you're looking for discussion of that nature, The Guardian's Focus podcast and recent Politics Weekly podcast covered all that in detail. Links are on your iPod screen now, or on this programme's page on our website. That said, let's look at what's happened so far. Charles, could you take us through the key points in the timeline since the first publication of the cables just over 2 weeks ago?
Okay, WikiLeaks began releasing the cables in association with the Guardian and also the New York Times on the 28th of November, and pretty much instantly was hit by a distributed denial of service attack, DDoS attack as it's called, which seems to have been launched by a shadowy hacker called The Jester, who... what we've heard is he's an American ex-military person who spends most of his time taking down jihadi websites. But he seems to have launched this big DDoS attack against WikiLeaks, which then moved from its servers to Amazon's EC2, Elastic Cloud Compute service, in order to host the data, and because Amazon is resilient against those sorts of attacks. However, Amazon removed the content around the end of November, beginning of December, sort of November 30th, December 1st, saying that it didn't think that WikiLeaks had the rights to the content. Meanwhile, Tableau Software, which provides data visualization, also removed the access to graphics based on the WikiLeaks data. And Tableau Software said that it had done so because Senator Joe Lieberman, who's a sort of independent but Democrat-aligned independent, had applied pressure and said that it was a bad thing. Lieberman then said that companies with ties to WikiLeaks should terminate their ties. Amazon, however, insisted that it had done it not because of that pressure, but because of what WikiLeaks was distributing, that it thought it might harm people. On December the 3rd, a company called Every DNS removed the routing service to WikiLeaks, which meant that if you typed wikileaks.org into your browser, you would get no result. It wouldn't actually be accessible. However, if you typed the machine address, which starts with 213.212 and goes on for four of those dotted quads, as they're known, then you'd still be able to get it. EveryDNS said that it was because of the DDoS attack, which had threatened the service, that it had removed the service. On December the 4th, PayPal suspended the WikiLeaks account, saying it broke its acceptable use policy. MasterCard and the Swiss banking service Post Finance also both withdrew facilities from WikiLeaks, in the case of Post Finance, from Julian Assange, who's the founder. On December the 7th, Julian Assange turned himself into British police and was arrested on unrelated charges of sexual assault, which had previously been dismissed in Sweden. He was not granted bail. There were then repeated failed attempts by Operation Payback to take down various sites. They did at one point manage to take down the MasterCard site. They had an effect on Visa. Twitter struggled a little bit for a while. And Operation Payback's accounts on Twitter and on Facebook were both taken down. And there have been some suggestions over the weekend that Amazon's European site might have been hit by Operation Payback, which is sort of run by a loose group of anonymous people, although Amazon has said it was due to a hardware failure. The Swedish prosecution office was also brought down by it.
So what do we know about Anonymous, and who are they? Who's leading this group?
Anonymous is a largely disorganized, a sort of chaotic group. I spent a lot of last Thursday in a forum where the Anonymous sort of users, if you like, gathered. Really, they're sort of an outgrowth of the bulletin board 4chan. There's a forum within there called /B, which has a lot of people, you know, basically anything goes. And when they decide that they want to go after someone or something, then they do it with all the skills at their command. Some of the people on /B are a lot more experienced than others. Some are basically just people who've rolled up and, you know, like to have a bit of a crack. But there are some serious hackers in there who control botnets of up to 25,000 PCs.
Graham, is this the first time we've seen attacks like this? Is this people that are very clear about their aims, or do they just want to really cause a lot of inconvenience for people?
We certainly have seen hacking groups launch political-based attacks in the past. For instance, there have been Indian versus Pakistan spats, and there have been issues between North and South Korea in the past. I think what makes this one somewhat different, however, is that they've been encouraging regular members of the public to participate in the attack as well. They've been trying to get, you know, Joe Public to download tools onto their computer, which will allow them to be part of the denial of service attack, part of the blast against the websites that we've seen. And that's unusual. And of course, it does raise some interesting legal questions as well as to whether regular members of the public are actually breaking the law by doing that and could get themselves in trouble.
Bill, this is perhaps the first true internet cyber war, isn't it? I mean, there's every element there. There's money, international politics, security, and the web, obviously. Is this really a cyber war?
I would imagine there have been other cyber wars, but this is really an unusual and unique event and very frightening, and for anybody that wants to protect freedom of expression online, because there's both government involvement and hacker involvement in trying to close down sites is just a terrible formula, I think, for having a chilling effect on and encouraging more regulation, for example.
What form would that regulation take, do you think?
Well, I just think that we already are in a period at which governments around the world are increasing efforts to try to, for example, a number of governments have increased their use of content filtering, and as one example of a move towards greater regulation of internet content. Something like this would probably encourage more movement in that direction rather than opening up the global internet as it should be.
Do you think that that's because of what WikiLeaks has done in terms of leaking the cables, or because what the Anonymous group is doing?
Well, I think it's because the whole story has been oversimplified and exaggerated, I think. I think clearly the WikiLeaks, as far as I can tell, it was not responsible for actually initially leaking the files, but it did redistribute them, but so did the press. And I think WikiLeaks has worked responsibly in many respects with the press to enable the public to get access to these files. And a variety of decisions, a variety of ethical issues involved that have been completely oversimplified and exaggerated and in a way that makes this a good versus evil kind of discussion. And anyway, I think it really needs some time for people to understand exactly who did what when.
Does it feel, Bill, like the U.S. government is really out for blood here? I mean, Bradley Manning, the U.S. soldier who downloaded the information initially and uploaded it to WikiLeaks, is in prison and facing an extremely long sentence. But there are many different players in the bigger picture, the people that brought this to public awareness. Have you got any inkling what the outcome will be further down the line?
No, I think this young man who was an Army intelligence analyst is in trouble if he did indeed do what he is accused of doing. And I do not know if there is any clear connection between him and WikiLeaks in terms of any encouragement. And I have never heard any evidence that I believe it was actually a hacker who discovered that he had leaked this and that WikiLeaks was a magnet and did receive this. But the cows were out of the barn, so to speak, and I think WikiLeaks is doing what the press has done.
Isn't there a certain amount of hypocrisy, though? Hillary Clinton, when Google said it had been attacked by Chinese hackers back in January, Hillary Clinton made a speech about freedom of the Internet and how important it was. But now that she doesn't like the sort of information that's coming out, suddenly the whole tenor changes. Do you think, Bill, that if we were hearing about someone who had uploaded Chinese diplomatic cables and if they were being pursued around by the Chinese security or Chinese politicians were making noises about this, do you think Hillary Clinton would be saying the same things as she is?
Hillary Clinton, I have heard her say that she regretted the fact that these files were leaked, but I didn't hear in Charles's report Hillary Clinton actively pursuing any course of action. You mentioned Joe Lieberman making a statement, and you know the American government and American politics is very diverse and pluralistic, and many people say many things. But I would be surprised if the U.S. State Department or Hillary Clinton is actively pursuing efforts to shut down any particular site.
So as we mentioned a moment ago, the hackers behind the attacks band themselves together under the collective title of Anonymous, a group that met and then span out of image board website 4chan around 2003. They've been responsible for attacks on the Record Industry Association of America and Ministry of Sound websites over their positions on file sharing. They've been responsible for attacks on the Record Industry Association of America and Ministry of Sound websites over their positions on file sharing, and famously, the Church of Scientology after it removed a Tom Cruise training video from YouTube. Alex Kratosky recently spoke to Christopher Poole, who goes by the name of Moot on the 4chan site he founded in 2003. He spoke to Alex on the phone for her new Untangling the Web series in The Observer. She asked him to explain how Anonymous came into being.
The roots of it are on 4chan. You know, as far back as six and a half years ago, it's funny because the way people, you know, at first started to use the site, everybody was used to coming from these web forums where you had to register an identity. You know, it's very rare that forums allow you to participate without registering. So 4chan was new and it was like, oh, hey, I don't have to register. But lots of people filled in the name field for the first few months, first year, and it was common to see people posting with it with an identity. So at first, the site was not super pro-anonymous, and it certainly wasn't, you know, at the age of, I think I was 17, or I'm sorry, 16 by that point, I wasn't really principled in this belief that anonymity was this powerful tool, you know, and I certainly didn't start 4chan as an outlet for dissenting voices and freedom of speech, and so it all kind of happened on its own. People eventually began to embrace anonymity as this thing that was so different about the sites that they were used to. And so with the rise of persistent identity and social network, people all of a sudden, I think, started to appreciate 4chan as, like, they saw how kind of radically different it was. And around probably about 2005, 2006, we begin to see, you know, Anonymous, not only is this just a kind of an aspect of the site, as just a feature, the fact that you don't have to register, but really as a thing, as a principle, and as this idea that, you know, we are one, we are a collective, you know, we are anonymous. Early 2008 is when the, I think it's like February or March 2008 is when the Anonymous versus Scientology process began. And that's when, you know, we transition from Anonymous as like an idea, this kind of binding ideology between users on 4chan, as now Anonymous isn't like a physical, like has kind of like it's a tangible being. It's a group of people united under a banner. And that's when, of course, they kind of waged this campaign against the Church of Scientology in response to the takedown of the Tom Cruise video on sites like YouTube. And now, you know, so moving forward from 2008 to 2010, now when you say Anonymous, that's the group. And at some point in the 4chan's history, there kind of was a split in the community between the initial set of users that were kind of the, you know, focused towards anime and who were, you know, kind of tame, and then the people who came into the site and not only kind of saw the Anonymous thing as this principled thing, but also started to exploit the anonymity as now, oh, hey, we have a platform where we can start to troll and start to be rebellious, and we're Anonymous, so nobody knows who we are. Because, you know, 4chan wasn't always, I mean, 4chan as it is now is not all trolls. When people think 4chan, they think the /B/random board, which is kind of the basket for the trolls. It's where they all gravitate. But 4chan has about 50 different topics, and when you look at the rest of the site, there's some pornography there, but more or less it's quite tame, and the discussion, the WorkSafe wars tend to be people are actually having real conversations.
You mentioned that it's the bin for the people who have almost adopted the identity anonymous, as it were, you know, the sort of the phenomenon. Have you adopted this idea that anonymous is an important thing about the web, that it should be protected?
I think anonymity, anonymous posting is, at the age of 15, it's not something that I believe strongly in, but you know, over the years now, it's something that I do believe in. I think, you know, the sites that allow anonymous posting are not common these days. And 10 years ago, it was rare that you had to register for a service to contribute. Now, I mean, 99% of them require you register before you contribute. And so I think, you know, 4chan is very quickly becoming the kind of the last place for this type of discourse, this type of interaction. And I think that's important.
What is important about being anonymous online?
It allows you to express views, opinions, share images that you wouldn't necessarily be comfortable expressing and sharing otherwise. And that doesn't necessarily mean that these have to be negative. I believe in what 4chan does, but I'm not a zealot by any means. I mean, I don't believe that it's the only way to do things. And Facebook has 500 million registered users now. People like what they're doing too. And I think that there's a place for both, and they both offer very powerful utility for different needs and for different people. And that, you know, again, 4chan is not the only way of doing it. Facebook's not the only way of doing it. And it's possible for both of them to add lots of value and to coexist.
I want to take a sort of a step back and look at some sort of more theoretical general questions about the web and your attitudes, your personal opinions about it. The first is, how would you say that radical actions online, so whether it's DDoS attacks or whether it's, you know, gaming polls and those types of things, how would you say that they're more sophisticated now than they were 10 years ago?
The amount of sophistication and time and energy and coordination amongst, you know, it wasn't one person, it was multiple parties, is incredible. It's something that you wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. I mean, that's fascinating. I think it's, you know, how people organize and participate and discovering communication has gotten so much easier online now, and that, like, enables that level of sophistication that you didn't see 10 years ago.
That was Moot from 4chan talking to Alex Krotowski. You can read more about Moot in Alex's Untangling the Web series at guardian.co.uk/untanglingtheweb. So, Bill, the action that the hackers are taking, is this really legitimate, do you think?
Well, let me respond by saying that I think this last discussion has the risk of conflating two very, very different aspects of anonymity. First, I mean, clearly anonymity is critical to freedom of expression. The right to be anonymous at some point in time, and if you have something to say that could prevent you from repercussions for speaking out, for example, is critical to freedom of expression. But that is very different from a group called Anonymous committing a denial of service attack to try to stop another website from speaking, in a sense. So, I mean, I do think anonymity is absolutely critical, but some of the actions of the group Anonymous, in my opinion, even though they're well-intentioned, are actually going to have the exact opposite impact and undermine freedom of expression if carried out.
So actually they're doing the cause of free speech a disservice by calling themselves Anonymous.
By actually suppressing speech, you do not promote free speech. And I think you're just promoting greater regulation and greater efforts to identify to undermine anonymity.
Well, in identifying these attacks, Charles, where are they largely coming from? Is it one particular country or area or any particular group that's affiliated with these?
No, it is distributed as far as anyone knows, and that's the reason why it's successful. The thing about a DDoS attack is that you can't protect against it because you're never quite sure where it's going to come from next. And there are various sorts of it. There's some discussion that the systems that are being used, the methods that are being used, are not the simple ping ones where you basically sort of run up to the front door of the website and ring the bell and run away. But there's also one called the Slow Loris, I think it's called, where you ask for a web page in a perfectly normal way, but you only accept the web page very, very slowly. And with Apache, this can have the effect that it fills up its memory trying to load this web page and pass the web page on. And basically, the memory gets full, the server falls over.
There's been quite a bit of infighting within Anonymous as well, hasn't there?
The difficulty is that trying to track what Anonymous is doing, it's not like politics. It's not like you have a leader and you have people who say what they're going to do and everyone refers to the leader and they might agree or disagree about it. It's more like trying to, you know, follow a flock of birds or a stampeding herd, because there's no clear direction except where it's going. And there's no clear decision-making except when it decides to go somewhere else. So what you see when you go into the forums and watch the sort of discussion take place is lots of things being thrown up. And if it gets a sort of a quorum of approval, then something starts to happen. And everyone says, OK, let's go after PayPal's API then. But you would never describe it as a decision-making process.
Graham, given how dysfunctional this group seems, no matter how persistent they are, they're never going to be able to compete with the resources that governments could and perhaps should be throwing at this problem, are they?
Well, let's not forget one thing. You know, they are anonymous. They are spread around the world. They're hard to identify, and they have that one big advantage over the large corporations and governments who they're currently fighting. So they're not going to be able to permanently bring down websites. They may disrupt them for periods of time. But they can cause a real nuisance.
Bill, do you think as a result of everything that's happened in the past few months that hacking and cyber war are going to move up the priority list for governments? They're going to think that they really need to start taking these threats much more seriously?
I think they will move up the agenda, but I do think that both in the case of the leaks and also the denial of service attacks right now, I think that all of these issues are picked up in what I would call a moral panic about the internet and among a variety of moral panics that are going on now. And I think this is not useful, because instead of trying to clarify and take time to understand what's going on, every actor seems to be instantaneously reacting in ways that are actually exacerbating the whole crisis as it's perceived.
Well, how effective have those attacks really been? Dave Birch is one of the UK's A-grade geeks. A director of IT management consultancy Consult Hyperion, he's also a purveyor of insight into digital security and a specialist in electronic transactions. Charles invited him in and asked how significant the latest Operation Payback attacks have really been.
I think the current attacks are actually relatively unsophisticated. So being able to knock somebody's website down for a little while, in the great scheme of things, doesn't really matter. And there are plenty of organisations you've seen with PayPal and Amazon who have very distributed systems, which actually make them very resilient against this kind of thing. I think it's more what they represent about the future, which is more interesting. So being able to persuade some kids to download a little bit of software and launch a DDoS attack, which, by the way, in the UK is quite an unwise strategy, because LOIC, which is the program that they're using, sends your IP address. And since in the UK launching a DDoS attack is punishable by 10 years in jail, it's actually not the strategy I'd adopt. But I think it's what it represents about the future which is more interesting, which is it possible to imagine more sophisticated forms of cyber activism, which this most definitely isn't, which could be more dangerous? And the answer to that, I think, is probably yes.
It might have been unsophisticated, but it still took it offline. And for people who wanted to, for example, pay their bills, if this was the last opportunity before some money went out of their account, that's quite frustrating.
Well, it didn't affect those kinds of transactions. I mean, what was taken down or what was interrupted was the secure code directory server. Now, actually, those directory servers go down from time to time anyway. It's just the nature of things.
What's a secure code directory server?
It's what redirects your payment back to your bank for your additional verification. Now, the payment service providers, for one reason or another, lose those gateways from time to time anyway. So what they do is they just process the payment without doing the verification. So, you know, it wasn't the end of Western civilization.
But equally, that could be a cover, couldn't it, for someone to do a whole lot of fake transactions?
I think it would have to be a very interesting conspiracy theory. I mean, it's more likely that it was an advance guard of a Chinese cyber attack testing our defences than it was a sophisticated attempt to swindle MasterCard using secure code.
Or that it was just an unsophisticated attack, that's the, which seems to be the Occam's razor version.
I'm from the tech side, right? So I have quite a harsh, you know, to me, you know, downloading a bit of software like that and running it isn't being a hacker. In fact, it's not even being an activist, because being an activist means putting yourself out, whereas being a slacktivist means putting other people out, which is what they were doing. My attitude to this was, and I absolutely stand by people's democratic right to protest on this, if you don't like MasterCard, cancel yours. You know, leave mine alone. It's got nothing to do with it. But as I say, it's what's interesting isn't those attacks. What's interesting is what they provide as a little window into the future. Remember, we were discussing a few weeks ago the impact of Stuxnet, you know, the virus which has apparently now been confirmed to have interfered with the Iranian nuclear program. That's the much more interesting case. If you were a dedicated activist and you wanted to cause havoc in some way, which, by the way, I'm not advocating, I'm merely commenting on, surely the Stuxnet route is the route that you'd take. And the reason why all those attacks work is because we have no identity infrastructure on the internet. We have this vanilla internet. And I can see two realistic outcomes of the current fuss. One is you end up with, if you like, a red and a blue internet. You end up with an authenticated, identity-centric internet, which is used by big business. And then you have a much more interesting digital divide than is imagined at the moment. Or we end up with an essentially more anarchic internet, which isn't used for real work anymore. And neither of those, to me, seem like particularly appealing outcomes. I think what we should do is we should probably look more, you know, I think the US is actually showing an interesting way here. They have this thing called USTIC, US Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. And I think maybe we should look at beginning to build something like that.
But with, for example, WikiLeaks didn't have a front man, a front person for quite a while when it launched. And in that situation, anonymity is quite important for the people who are providing information to it. The first documents, I think, it leaked back in 2006 were to do with Daniel Arap Moy and money that seemed to have gone from Kenya overseas.
Well, I agree. And again, you know, without making political points about this, I can think of an enormous number of cases where anonymity is absolutely desirable. This is Ben Lorry's point, which is if you don't have an anonymous internet to begin with, you can never build in anonymity later on. You must have space for anonymity.
How do you square the circle of thinking that anonymity is necessary for some things and yet wanting it not to be there for people who are doing bad things?
There are cryptographic means for proving something about yourself without disclosing your identity. You remember the cryptographic blinding that we used to talk about in the old days about voting and so on and so forth. So, I think we need to distinguish the specific technical solutions to specific technical problems around anonymity and the general issue. It would be wrong to take anonymity away from the internet because there are circumstances where you need it. You know, conversely, if I'm a bank or me, frankly, and you're sending me email, I want to know who you are.
That was Dave Birch. Now, Charles, how much of the success of these attacks were down to luck? And if we look at what happened to Visa and MasterCard and also to PayPal and Amazon, which was questionably down to hacking, but let's for the sake of argument, say it was, how much does that show that the banks are perhaps a little bit more lax than they should be with their security?
I think it has more to do actually with the characteristics of Anonymous itself as a, quotes, group, which is that when they sort of first got together over this matter and said, well, let's go and hit someone because we're really angry about something and we're, you know, feeling a bit inchoate about it, but we're going to do something. The idea of hitting MasterCard, because MasterCard had stopped passing on payments to WikiLeaks, that was the first target. That was a nice, easily described target, and so they were able to hit it, and that was very focused. They had, you know, a lot of the people with the real specialist skills in there went after it. I think that once that had been done, then the group lost a bit of focus, because the problem is, you know, once you've done one thing, okay, how do you choose your next target? And going after PayPal, going after Amazon, that's actually more difficult. Just to get the group to say, well, which of these two targets should we go for? Much easier if you have a choice of only one.
But if you're moving on to, you know, okay, well, which are we going to be able to do more easily? Is it Amazon? Is it PayPal? And there was a lot of, you know, disagreement about this on the forums. And I think that's actually what happened, is that basically it fizzled out, because with a sort of herd like that, you can't quite make it do what you want to. It sort of becomes like herding cats.
Can you fill us in a bit on what happened with Amazon?
Amazon's servers in the UK, in Germany, in France, Italy and Spain went offline for about half an hour on Sunday evening. That was from about 9 o'clock in the evening to 9:30.
And they insisted this was a hardware problem.
They said it was a hardware problem. And to be honest, I'm inclined to think that's probably true, because all of those sites are actually served from a data centre in Ireland. You can look it up on Netcraft. And it all points back to the same place. So that, to me, suggests that it was a network failure rather than being some attack by all the people from Anonymous. Because as much as anything, it's a kind of strange time of the day for that to be happening.
But they were definitely on the hit list, though, weren't they?
Well, they were sort of on the hit list, and then they weren't, because within the forums, the discussion was, well, actually, Amazon's got big, resilient infrastructure. You know, it's built for cloud computing. It's got all these servers all over the place. It can offload.
Not the best place to try and attack.
Really. So, yeah, well, exactly. You don't try to sort of punch a sort of giant mattress.
Bill, WikiLeaks tweeted recently that if Amazon has a problem with free speech, it should get out of the business of selling books. Ethically, do you think that's correct?
I don't know what the decisions were at Amazon, but I do know that they're reported to have been under pressure to stop mirroring of WikiLeaks sites.
And they famously have material for sale that is kind of borderline paedophile material.
And equally, they sell Mein Kampf, I would imagine.
Again, I think what's unfortunate about it is this whole battle has escalated into a discussion of what we should censor and who should get off taking people offline. There was a security breach in the government itself, and they should fix that. That should be the focus of discussion about how the government will not leave the barn doors open.
Although equally, I've seen an argument that because this was produced by government employees, by the diplomats and intelligence analysts, as the nice phrase goes, it is produced by the US government, therefore no copyright can attach to it. The U.S. government actually, specifies that content generated by U.S. government employees cannot have a copyright attached to it. So, all the Barack Obama photos from his inauguration and so on, those are all copyright free. And surely this must apply to any of those diplomatic cables as well.
Well, copyright is a totally different issue than secrecy or confidentiality. A claim of copyright has just to make sure that you get credit. I'm sure most people wouldn't want any copyright attributed to their diplomatic messages.
It's not a bad thing, though, is it, that a lot of these ethical issues have been brought up by WikiLeaks and the kind of businesses that the business practices that mean Visa and MasterCard are handling payments for the Knights Party, for example, which funds the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, it's good that these are being brought to light, isn't it?
Certainly. I think that if it creates a very constructive discussion about freedom of expression, I think for too long, freedom of expression was sort of relegated as a criticisms of a few countries that were perceived to be less open. But clearly, it suggests two things. One is that freedom of expression is absolutely worldwide, and every country needs to consider how to support this in the correct ways. And that basic human rights, like freedom of expression and access to government information and so forth, are being fought out online, so that the internet is becoming a focus of basic human rights issues.
Graham, Dave's outlook was quite positive as far as the financial institutions were concerned. Do you think he was a bit too dismissive of the power of the hackers?
I think generally financial institutions do protect their systems pretty well. In terms of the types of businesses who we regularly speak with here at Sophos, the financial institutions seem to have the best IT security teams. They seem to be thinking most about these sort of issues and are defending themselves often much better, actually, than government institutions. So I think they generally are doing pretty well. So I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I think all organizations will be looking more and more at how they can protect themselves online from attacks like denial of service, how they can reduce that kind of threat in order to defend themselves better in the future. But that can be a costly thing to do that, efficiently. It's all right for these really big websites like Google and Amazon, but for some of the smaller websites out there, they may not have the resources to put up a really strong defense should someone decide to target them.
And just before we wrap up, Graham, what happens from here? Looking to the future, what would you suspect are now the key targets for groups like Anonymous?
Oh, well, it's a dangerous thing, and I don't necessarily want to put ideas into their head as to who they should attack next. But certainly, I mean, there are going to be decisions made soon about Julian Assange. He has these rather unconnected with WikiLeaks charges against him at the moment, and there'll be questions as to whether the British, for instance, are going to ship him off back to Sweden or elsewhere. And if those decisions aren't supported by the groups like Anonymous, I put groups in inverted commas, then maybe there's the potential for some British government or judicial websites to be next in the firing line. Who knows? But I would like everyone to remember, if they're thinking of participating in these attacks, they are against the law. We've already seen arrests in the Netherlands connected with these denial of service attacks from people who've decided to run the tool. The tool which has been made available doesn't hide the identity of your computer. And there is a maximum penalty of 10 years in jail in the UK if you do participate in a denial of service attack. So, you can't really claim that you don't know what you're doing.
If I could slightly disagree with, well, there was a comment that these were not technologically sophisticated attacks, and I accept that. But I think socially they were sophisticated. That is, they relied upon getting many people to participate. And I think that the critical thing is many people will not participate if they understand the complexity and understand what is going on here and the potential damage that can be done by participating in these events. And so I think it's really imperative that the press, and I'm glad you're recovering this, that the public understands exactly what is happening and the various decisions and the various complexities of this, so that people are not responding in a overly simplistic way to an appeal, because if people understood this correctly, there would not be a mass appeal. And I doubt that there has been yet, but I think there will not be, because I think the press is going to get more and more information out about exactly who did what and when.
And Charles, what will the legacy be of this whole episode, the legacy on governments and how hackers are seen and how people engage with this kind of campaign?
Gosh, I feel it's a bit like when Mao Zedong was asked about the French Revolution, 200 years after it happened, and asked what he thought of it, and he said, "Too soon to tell." It really is very soon to tell quite what the fallout is going to be from this. I think that WikiLeaks is a fascinating phenomenon, and there's even a sort of a follow-up organisation now called OpenLeaks, which is looking just to sort of be a conduit to news organisations of leaks that are provided. So I suspect that that's going to be one of the things. I think that the whole swarming phenomenon, where you get groups like Anonymous who try to go after people, is going to be interesting. But I suspect that Anonymous is actually the only one that really has the mass to be able to do this. So I think everyone's going to be much more wary, and I think that probably politicians, or at least government politicians, will be a lot more cautious before they say that they think it's a really great idea that the internet is used for free speech, especially if there's the possibility that all their personal cables and secret information will be spread all around it.
That's all for this week's programme. Thanks very much to Charles and to Bill and Graham. Follow all the WikiLeaks-related news at guardian.co.uk. Just a reminder that next week's programme will be a look back at the tech highlights of the year. What were the big moments for you in 2010? Was Google's move to end censorship of its search results in China the most important tech event of the year? Was it the passing of the Digital Economy Act? Please don't tell us it was the launch of the iPad, because we've already made a note of that one. Tweet us your suggestions or leave your comments on our blog or Facebook wall. The links are all at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The programme was produced by Scott Corley, and I'm Jemima Kish. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.